Welcome, everyone, to a program brought to you by Copyright Clearance Center, a very special webinar updating the Google Books case, a new high watermark on transformative use. And on October 16th, the U.S. Federal Appeals Court ruled in favor of Google and against the Authors Guild in a copyright infringement case that began 10 years ago over Google's controversial book scanning project. This opinion will have enormous impact for years to come on fair use analyses and jurisprudence. In today's program, we will learn how the court's decision affects authors, publishers, and their readers, what makes the Google Books project a fair use case, and why the Authors Guild may decide to ultimately appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. My name is Christopher Keneally, and again, I want to welcome everyone from across North America, Europe, and indeed around the world to our very special program. The Second Circuit's court decision on October 16th affirmed an earlier decision holding that Google's book scanning project was fair use under copyright law, and this decision has been portrayed in the press as a victory for Google. But Judge Pielaval did more and also less than hand the search engine giant a win in court. It's more than just a win for Google, because Judge Laval's opinion has expanded our understanding of what makes a transformative use. It's less than an outright win because the decision is so tied into the specific facts presented by the record, limitations and restrictions in the current Google Books offering, that there may be some real questions about broader applicability to other future scanning and search projects. Adding to the interest here is the fact that this discussion of what constitutes transformative use was written by the originator of the argument that transformative uses are to be favored in fair use analyses. Pierre Laval's 1990 Harvard Law Review article first articulated this idea, planting the seed for landmark findings in a number of cases, especially Campbell versus Acuff Rose, the so-called Pretty Woman case. So there's a lot to talk about today as we review this latest decision and its broader implications. Now, if you do have any questions for us today, we remind you that you should use the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen, and we'll get to as many of those questions at the end of the program as we can. But at this point, I want to take a moment to review the timeline involved with the Google Books case and take us back more than a decade to 2004 when Google began its library scanning project, digitizing millions of books in the collection of major academic libraries with the permission of the libraries, but without the permission of the copyright owners of those works in the collections that were still in copyright. In 2005, two lawsuits were brought in the U.S. District Court, Southern District of New York, against Google in connection with the scanning, one on behalf of the publishers and one on behalf of the authors, both claiming that Google was engaging in copyright infringement. Google defended its actions, saying they were covered by fair use, and a protracted period of negotiation subsequently followed between Google on the one hand and the authors and publishers together on the other. In 2008, the parties announced they had agreed to the terms of a settlement. And since the Authors Guild case had been brought as a class action in 2005, the agreed settlement would have been binding on members of a large class of copyright owners and required court approval. To describe the proposed settlement as controversial would be a gross understatement. In response to a lot of expressed criticism and concern, the parties withdrew the original settlement agreement, went back to the negotiating table, and in 2009 announced they had agreed to a new second settlement. The court held a fairness hearing on the new agreement in 2010, and in 2011, the settlement agreement was rejected. That rejection resulted in a split for purposes of the litigation between the publishers and the authors. The publishers quietly settled with Google on terms that have not been made public in any detail, but which clearly permitted Google to continue with its scanning project and the Google Book Search service that resulted from it. The Authors Guild, however, did not settle, so the legal challenge to the Google Library project continued. Finally, in November 2013, Judge Denny Chin in the Second Circuit found Google's activity to fall within fair use according to an analysis of the four factors that in the United States determine fair use. And as a reminder, those four factors are the purpose and character of the use, including whether it's for commercial use or for nonprofit educational purposes, the nature of the copyrighted work, fiction or nonfiction, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyright-protected work as a whole, and finally, the fourth factor, the effect of the use on the potential market for or value of the copyright-protected work. Now, the Authors Guild has appealed Judge Denny Chin's conclusion on that basis, and they asserted that Google had violated copyright law by providing copies of the works that it scanned to the libraries participating in the scanning program. So with the decision on October 16th in 2015, we are finally now getting to an answer to the fair use question that was raised in the lawsuits filed in 2005. And for an analysis of the answers that the judge has given, we want to turn now to Lois Wassoff. And we welcome you back, Lois, to this series. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to see you.
I had to look it up, Lois. We've been doing this since 2009, and it's a pleasure to have you back with us, but I'm not sure in 2009 we anticipated we would be here in 2015. The Second Circuit's unanimous decision from the three-judge panel, written by Judge Pierre Laval, confirmed the lower court ruling on both points, fair use and the library copies. But we're going to focus on the fair use aspects of the case today. So how did Judge Laval reach that conclusion?
Judge Laval first concluded that the uses, Google's uses, that had been challenged by the Authors Guild served a transformative purpose. He then goes through in painstaking detail exactly what Google is and isn't doing with the scans that it created through its library scanning project. He discusses that the digital corpus created by the scanning permits searching by members of the public of specific words and terms, that as a result of the searcher locates information about the work, but doesn't get access to the expressive content of the work except in the form of snippets. And then he really looks at that snippet delivery, the snippet view that's permitted by Google Book Search. And he emphasizes that the snippets are limited in length and number, are blocked from 1 out of 10 pages for most books, or in the cases of books like dictionaries, cookbooks, books of short poems, the snippets are blocked entirely. He then goes on to analyze those specific facts under the four fair use factors that you've just described, the nature and purpose of the use, nature of the work, amount of the taking, and market impact. And he discusses each one in turn.
All right. Well, let's look in more detail what the opinion says on each of those factors. The discussion of transformative use in relation to the first fair use factor is of particular interest, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. Absolutely. Both for what is said, and also, as you've already noted, because of who is saying it. Judge Laval modestly refrains from citing himself in the opinion, but it's not possible to read his discussion of transformative use without remembering that he was the author of that 1990 Harvard Law Review article that articulated the concept that transformative uses were to be favored in fair use analysis. So when he makes a finding that the copying of entire works for the purpose of including them in a digital corpus to facilitate searching serves a transformative purpose, it's significant. Judge Laval begins by quoting that famous language in the Campbell case, the transformative use lies at the heart of the fair use doctrine. And then he goes on in his own words to say, transformative uses tend to favor a fair use finding because a transformative use is one that communicates something new and different from the original or expands its utility, thus serving copyright's overall objective of contributing to public knowledge. In his view, the copying done in this case is in support of a transformative purpose because it lets searchers locate information about original works rather than providing them with access to the actual expression contained in the works.
So to make it clear then, it's not the scanning itself that's transformative, but the purposes for which the scans are used.
Exactly. If the purpose for making the scans were to provide access to the expressive content of the works, the outcome would almost definitely be different. And that is one of the interesting things about the opinion. Judge Laval really focuses on transformative purpose rather than transformative use. What Google is using the original works for is to create scanned digital copies of entire works and incorporate them into a digital corpus. Judge LaValle very quickly looks past those acts of copying and directly to Google's stated purpose for doing it, which Google says is to facilitate access to information about the works through searching. Transformative use of a protected work used to mean that the secondary user, the putative fair user, added something new to the original work that created a new work of authorship. That's the Campbell Pretty Woman case that you alluded to. The original Roy Orbison song was used to create a new work that was a parody of the original. Here, no new protected expression is being added. The copying of the work is adding a new utility, not a new expression. It's a different, although certainly not at all unprecedented, way of looking at transformative use. And although Judge LaValle doesn't seem to have a problem with the large amount of text being copied, he does throughout the opinion emphasize how little of that text, how little of the expressive, protected content of each work is being made available through the Google Book search program. And he therefore describes how unlikely it is, in his view, that those search results could serve as a market substitute or even have a significant negative impact on the market value of the original work. That lack of market substitution point comes up a lot in the decision. It comes up in his discussion of the first factor, and he also brings it up when he discusses the third and the fourth factors, the amount of the taking and market harm.
All right. So I think it's important to note that this outcome on the transformative use, transformative purpose aspect of the Google scanning project really isn't a surprise. This tracks pretty closely with what the Second Circuit said in the HathiTrust case, doesn't it? Maybe we should take a moment to remind everyone about that case, the HathiTrust case, and the court's opinion there.
Well, the HathiTrust case was also brought by the Authors Guild. The Guild brought an action against the library consortium that had been formed by the libraries that had participated in the original scanning project to make use of the digital copies that they were getting back from Google. And although that case was initiated after the original case directly against Google, after the case that addressed the underlying scanning project, for a variety of procedural reasons, the fair use issue reached the Second Circuit, reached the appellate level court, sooner than the fair use issue in the original Google Books case. It reached the Second Circuit in 2013. Judge LaValle did not write that decision, but he relies on it and describes it as an exemplary decision. He quotes the HathiTrust decision for the proposition that the creation of a full-text searchable database is a quintessentially transformative use, as the result of a word search is different in purpose, character, expression, meaning, and message from the page and the book from which it is drawn. But he also points out, Judge LaValle also points out, that there are some very important distinctions between the Google Books case, the case against Google itself that resulted in the opinion we're discussing today, and the situation in HathiTrust. The first difference is that the search results from a HathiTrust search did not display any text at all from the underlying work. There was no snippet view. And the second is that HathiTrust is a nonprofit entity, while Google is a commercial one.
All right, so those are differences, perhaps important ones, but as we know, they didn't ultimately change the result.
No, they didn't. But this is the part of the opinion where he discusses the snippet view that arguably moves from stating general principles to being very, very much tied to the specifics of exactly how Google is using the scans. As you pointed out, Chris, scanning itself is not transformative use. The questions of why the scans are being created and how they're being used have to be addressed. The fair use analysis in this case is very explicitly tied into exactly what the record before the court shows Google is actually doing. So the opinion emphasizes that there are limitations in the snippets that are delivered as search results. It says those snippets are designed to show the searcher just enough content surrounding the search term, and I'm quoting him here, to help her evaluate whether the book falls within the scope of her interest without revealing so much as to threaten the author's copyright interest. With these limitations, Snippet View adds, according to Judge LaValle, to the highly transformative purpose of identifying books of interest to the searcher. But Judge LaValle does acknowledge that this transformative purpose, however compelling he finds it, could be overcome if the Snippet View was structured in a way that provided text in a manner that offers a competing substitute. We'll see that phrase, competing substitute, a lot for plaintiff's books. The decision is just replete with statements like that. And I don't think it's possible to overemphasize that the court was ruling on this particular scanning project with these specific characteristics. Professor Jane Ginsburg of Columbia Law School recently wrote an article that makes the argument that the decision is so tied into the specific facts before the court that it can really be considered sui generis, just standing on its own. And I can certainly see, based on these kinds of very repeated specific acknowledgments that this ruling applies to these facts, why she might draw that conclusion.
Interesting. Well, what about the question of whether the use is for commercial or nonprofit educational purposes, which we know also comes up as a first factor point in discussions? How did Judge LaValle address that issue, commercial versus nonprofit uses?
Well, this is a part of the opinion that I really find particularly interesting, and I think it's written in a way that, in my view, is intended to be considered beyond the specific facts of the case. Judge LaValle notes elsewhere in the opinion that Google doesn't charge for searching and no advertising is displayed with search results. But in the discussion of whether the first factor should weigh against Google because of the fact of Google's existence as a commercial entity, Judge LaValle doesn't refer to those specific circumstances, nor does he acknowledge that Google has undoubtedly received a great deal of indirect commercial benefit from the scanning and from the resulting corpus to enhance its search offerings and generally increase traffic to its sites. Instead, he discusses the issue in more general terms, explicitly rejecting the idea that commercial uses are presumptively disfavored. He points out, and again, I'm going to quote here, many of the most universally accepted forms of fair use, such as news reporting and commentary, quotation in historical or analytical books, reviews of books and performances, as well as parody, are all normally done commercially for profit. And then he does something interesting. Judge LaValle is ruling on the case before him. And the question of whether nonprofit uses are favored is not before him. Google's a commercial entity, and the question before him was, does that count against Google? But he doesn't leave the question of the implications for nonprofit entities unaddressed. He includes a footnote in which he clearly states his view. He says, just as there is no reason for presuming that a commercial use is not a fair use, which would defeat the most widely accepted and logically justified areas of fair use, there is likewise no reason to presume categorically that a nonprofit educational purpose should qualify as fair use.
All right. Well, I'd like to return to this point about which aspects of the decision are tied to the particular set of facts that would make them sui generis in Jane Ginsburg's assessment, and which are more generally applicable. But first, Lois, if you'd take us through the other factors as analyzed by the court.
Sure. Well, as is the case in most fair use decisions, the court doesn't spend much time discussing the second factor, the nature of the work being copied. But Judge LaValle does make some observations that are of interest. In particular, he rejects the idea that factual works are entitled to less copyright protection than imaginative or fictional ones. He says, quoting, at least unless a persuasive fair use justification is involved, authors of factual works, like authors of fiction, should be entitled to copyright protection of their protected expression. The mere fact that the original is a factual work, therefore, should not imply that others may freely copy it. As it happens, the three works specifically at issue in the case, the three named plaintiffs, were all writers of nonfiction works, though the works specifically at issue are nonfiction. But Judge LaValle says that the outcome would have been the same had they been fiction. He goes back to what he found to be the highly transformative nature of the challenged use. And he says, the second factor favors fair use not because plaintiffs' works are factual, but because the secondary use transformatively provides valuable information about the original rather than replicating protected expression in a manner that provides a meaningful substitute for the original. So he's introduced the concept of the importance of transformation into the second factor analysis. And then in discussing the third factor, which is the amount and substantiality of the portion used, he returns to that theme. And he returns to his theme that what is most significant is whether the secondary use, the challenged use, can substitute for the original. He states categorically that copying of an entire work can be fair use, saying that, quoting, completely unchanged copying has repeatedly been found justified as fair use when the copying was reasonably appropriate to achieve the copier's transformative purpose and was done in such a manner that it did not offer a competing substitute for the original. It's an interesting approach to this factor because the amount that he considers relevant is not the amount of the taken from the work that's being copied. Instead, he focuses on the amount and substantiality of what is thereby made accessible to a public for which it may serve as a competing substitute. And then he brings back his discussion of snippet view and the limitations inherent in snippet view. He goes on to say, and this is another place where he's tying back into the specific facts of what Google was doing, he says that at least as presently structured by Google, the specific limitations imposed on snippets as enabled by the current search offering don't provide a significantly competing substitute for the copyrighted work. The approach he's taking in analyzing the second and third factors is, I think, interesting and kind of different. We're used to seeing fair use discussions talk about the close relationship between the first and the fourth factors. In other words, that the more transformative the use, which is arguably a first factor issue, the less likely that use is to be a market substitute for the original, which comes up under the fourth factor. But Judge LaValle brings transformative use and market substitution into the second and third factors as well, stating that both tilt in favor of Google. He never says that a finding of transformative purpose trumps the other factors. But he certainly threads the finding of transformative use through the entire analysis.
Right. Well, you know, Lois, to this non-legal mind, following all this is rather like following a kind of complicated piece of music until finally a theme emerges, and there does seem to be a clear theme emerging here in the emphasis and the opinion on whether the secondary use is a substitute for the original. I have to assume that Judge LaValle considers the fourth factor, market impact, to be particularly important.
Yes, that's right. There was a time in fair use jurisprudence when the accepted wisdom was that the fourth factor, market impact, was entitled to the most weight of the four. More recent cases seem to have moved away from that emphasis, but Judge LaValle's opinion really seems to bring the fourth factor back to center stage. In his words, because copyright is a commercial doctrine whose objective is to stimulate creativity among potential authors by enabling them to earn money from their creations, the fourth factor is of great importance in making a fair use assessment. And as we've discussed, that ties back to the first factor, to transformative use as well. The more transformative the use, the less likely there is to be a market substitution. But Judge LaValle's view is that the fourth factor has significant importance. And he says, even if the purpose of the copying is for a valuably transformative purpose, such copying might nonetheless harm the value of the copyrighted original if done in a manner that results in widespread revelation of sufficiently significant portions of the original as to make available a significantly competing substitute. And again, he says, at least as presently constructed, Google's use of snippet view in making small excerpts of expressive content available doesn't constitute a market substitute. But even as he's acknowledging the importance of the fourth factor, he's pointing out some limitations. First, he's saying the market harm has to be significant. Occasional incidental losses of sales don't meet that standard. There must be, in his view, a meaningful or significant effect upon the market for or value of the work. And secondly, he makes the point that the competing substitute must be for the protected content of the work, the expressive content of the work. Locating a fact in a snippet might satisfy a searcher's particular need and result in a lost sale, but that doesn't constitute market harm in Judge LaValle's view because the facts included in a work are not part of their protected content. And then he goes further. He says that because the snippets are delivered in response to a search are brief and they're aggregated in what he calls a cumbersome and disjointed way, it would be a rare case in which the searcher's interest in the protected aspect of the author's work would be satisfied. So while he acknowledges the fourth factor significant, his discussion on the point really focuses almost entirely on lost sales of a full copy of the work, which, as we know, is not the only right a creator has under copyright.
Right. Well, then one critical factor in the outcome was the court's determination that Google Book Search was intended to provide information about the copied works rather than to provide access to the expressive content of the works themselves. So it's about the works, not access to the content. And we've already discussed another area of the decision that you believe will have some general application regarding the weight to be given to whether a challenged use is commercial or nonprofit. So are there other aspects of the case that you think will have broader impact? Or is this decision just telling us that the Google Scanning Project and current book search service are fair use? Does it have more general application?
Well, as we said, the decision is primarily about the specifics of the activities challenged by the Authors Guild, and that's as it should be. Fair use is designed to be a fact-specific, flexible doctrine that should be applied on a case-by-case basis. But I think there are some general themes we can draw from the decision that could potentially help guide all of us in making fair use determinations, and that could inform court decisions in future when they review those determinations. In addition to the things you've already noted, I think the decision provides some guidance on the difference between a transformative fair use, which does not require permission from or payment to the copyright owner, and the creation of a derivative work, which does. As the reach of fair use has expanded over the last several years, the possibility of an overlap between those two concepts, transformative fair use and derivative work, has been of real concern. I think Judge LaValle's discussion of this point may help define the boundary. Derivative works, according to the opinion, represent the protected aspects of the original work, that is, its expressive content, converted into an altered form. And he gives examples like converting a novel into a film, translating a work into a different language, reproducing a painting as a poster, making a plush toy based on a cartoon character, adapting musical composition for different instruments. He doesn't ignore the argument that's made by the Authors Guild that there is a paid and an unpaid market for licenses of portions of their works, but he distinguishes situations like the licensing of excerpts from books to Amazon for its Look Inside the Book service, or telephone ringtones based on copyrighted songs, because he says that where the value to the licensee is in the expressive contents of the work. And he distinguishes those situations from licenses that provide information about the underlying work, which he says is not a derivative work controlled by the copyright holder. Copyright holders for years have licensed third parties to include all or parts of their work in anthologies, collections, and digital databases. Under Judge LaValle's approach, whether such a license implicates copyright is a function of the user licensee's interest and purpose, not the copyright owner's right to permit or to refuse the reproduction of her works. And I think we should keep in mind that the specific finding that Google has not violated the derivative work rights of the plaintiff is, again, based on the factual record before the court. Google has full copies of the works and, in theory, could provide access to their expressive content. But it hasn't yet, except in the very limited framework of Snippet View. And so it hasn't made expressive content available in a way that's significant enough to trouble Judge LaValle. And as long as Google doesn't do that, in his view, it's not infringing on plaintiffs' exclusive rights to authorize the conversion of their works into different formats for delivery to those who want to access their expressive content.
Well, it's remarkable listening to you, Lois, because I have a great admiration not only for your analysis, but for Judge LaValle, who really seems to have written a very thoroughly reasoned and very scrupulously careful decision. It's fascinating to have you unravel it that way, and we appreciate that. If you have a question about either the decision or Lois's analysis, you can use the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. Let us know what your question is about, and we will try to get to as many of those as we can before the end of our program today. So finally then, Lois, is this the end of the road? We've been here, as we said, since 2009. Well, the case goes back to 2004. Is this finally, at long last, the end of the road for the Google Books case? Will this decision be the last word?
Well, we don't know yet. The Authors Guild has said it is going to appeal the case to the Supreme Court. So there is a chance the case isn't over yet. The Google Books dispute has gone on, as you've said, Chris, for years. And it's produced a number of court opinions. But the Supreme Court hasn't yet been heard on the subject. We also, though, need to keep in mind that the Supreme Court agrees to hear only a very small percentage of the cases it's asked to rule on. So if the Guild does, in fact, appeal, as I expect it will, it'll file a petition for certiorari, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. And then, of course, when you ask, is this the end of the road for Google Books, you know, there's also Google itself to consider. Judge LaValle was at pains to remind everyone, including Google, that the court was ruling on a very specific set of facts, that the search capacity was being made available to the public at large without charge, that there was no advertising or direct commercial benefit to Google, that only limited amounts of actual authorial expression was being made available, and that those limited amounts are being made available in a way that don't serve as a market substitute for the original work. If Google changes how it conducts itself and is challenged, the fair use question would have to be considered again in light of those new facts.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, Lois. And, you know, although our attention has been focused on a courthouse in Manhattan, we may all have to get on the train and get out to Washington, D.C. if the Authors Guild does indeed appeal, as you suggest they certainly have every right to do. And we now turn to the questions from our audience. We have been very happy to have you join us today on a very special program updating the Google Books case and looking at whether or not indeed it is a high watermark for transformative use. And if you have a question for our panelists today, Lois Wassoff, please use the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. Let us know what you are thinking about, what you'd like to know more about. There will be a recording made available to all the attendees today, so you can share that with colleagues and also check back and be sure you've got the full story there. We do have a question, Lois, that I think is worth bringing up here because it does go to the facts of the case, and as you ended your discussion about just exactly what Google has done so far. And Krista wants to know whether this decision considers the impact of copying a work and the use of the work by Google internally while it was carrying out the project. And Krista imagines that employees and people at Mountain View and anywhere else at Google may have had access and used the work without copyright holders' permission. So it sounds like the decision is only considering the impact on the overall public. It's a thoughtful question from Krista. How do you respond to that?
It's an excellent question, and I think she's highlighted something that is an omission in the decision. And I don't think it was an inadvertent one, because Judge LaValle is a very, very thoughtful judge and a very smart person. And the decision includes what he intended to include and doesn't include what he didn't want to address. And the answer is the decision really does not talk about internal uses being made by Google. It doesn't talk about other advantages to Google or its employees in having access to this corpus. It talks about the ways in which Google protects the corpus. And we can talk about that too, the hacking issue and how Google provides access to the corpus to the public for search purposes, but protects the corpus from public access for other purposes. But this is not a question that was addressed and could have been, particularly in the discussion about Google's existence as a commercial entity and whether or not there was benefit to Google. It's an interesting aspect of the decision. I think the question gets to that a little bit too. The judge puts Google in the position of its users, of its public users, if that makes sense.
We used to call them readers.
Yeah, well, now they're
searchers. For books in the paper.
Now they're users or searchers. And it looks at the benefits to them, and it looks at their purposes, the sort of non-directly commercial uses that the results of these searches will presumably be put to. But it doesn't. The decision really doesn't talk very much about Google as a commercial entity. So it's an interesting, and I'm sure not accidental, decision on the part of Judge LaValle to not emphasize this aspect of what Google is doing.
All right. Well, we appreciate that question, and thank you for a thoughtful answer, Lois. As I mentioned, we have really a tremendous audience here joining us today from across North America, Europe, and indeed around the world. And we have a number of people from the library community. And we said at the outset that we were going to be focusing on the fair use aspect of this case. But what did the court say about copies provided to the libraries themselves? These are the libraries that allowed Google access for the scanning project in the first place.
Well, actually, he surprisingly little, though he does, in fact, make a holding on that issue. At the beginning of the opinion, he notes that the libraries have downloaded, I think the number's 2.5 to 3 million digital copies, at least 2.5 to 3 million digital copies of the works, that of the digital versions of the works that had come from their collections. He also mentions and quotes provisions in the agreements between Google and the libraries that require the libraries to use the digital copies in a manner consistent with copyright law, and that also require the libraries to take precautions to prevent dissemination of the digital copies to the public at large. And then at the end of the opinion, he just states categorically that it isn't an infringement for Google to give copies to the libraries because, in his view, the libraries could have made those copies themselves for the purpose of conducting what he calls fair use digital searches. Any accusations, any concerns expressed by the Authors Guild, to the contrary, he calls speculation. So he does definitely make a decision about the copies provided to the libraries and says that Google's provision of those copies is non-infringing.
And that seems to be an answer sort of related to the first question we had, because it's really about those copies and what's been done with them so far. So if things change, and of course they possibly could, things have changed a lot since 2004 for Google and for publishing, that may raise other legal issues itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right.
All right. Well, Lois Wassef, we have been very happy to have you join us. We have another question that is actually related to these databases and the possibility of whether or not these databases could be hacked, for example. Is that a concern that the judge looks at?
It was definitely a concern that was expressed by the Authors Guild. It is an argument that the Authors Guild made that by the proliferation of these copies, the existence of these copies in digital corpuses. That sounds like, what's the plural of corpus?
Corpora, said the Latin scholar.
Thank you very much. Corpora had the potential to create market harm. And Laval addresses that. He dismisses those concerns. And he's pretty definitive about it, at least with respect to the Google digital corpus. It's part of the record, apparently, because Judge Laval quotes it, that Google uses the same very robust protection measures to protect the digital copies that it uses for its own confidential information. And that representation was enough to assure the court that the expressive content of the works was really not at risk for hacking. It raises another issue, but this might take us down a tangent a little bit. Very often in considering the fourth factor, the market harm factor, courts evaluate whether the cumulative effect of the challenge behavior, if it were to become widespread, whether that could have a negative impact on the value of the work. And Judge Laval,
kind of a slow, steady erosion, if
you
will.
Yeah, yeah. But Judge Laval didn't really include that in his four-factor analysis. So to the extent that this decision might be in future read as legitimizing extensive scanning projects and the creation of digital databases of works by other entities, I think you could argue it could have such cumulative effect. Not all entities doing that kind of copying and storing will necessarily have the resources and ability that Google does to provide robust protection against hacking. But, that's not the issue that was before. That's not an issue that Judge Laval chose to consider in his opinion.
Yeah.
And so it's not an aspect of this case at the moment.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank Lois Wassef for this fascinating analysis. We have been chatting with her today about the recent October 16th decision in the U.S. Federal Appeals Court in favor of Google and against the Authors Guild in a copyright infringement case that began over 10 years ago. We've been looking at it sort of answering the question, is it a new high water mark on transformative use? And our very special guest today has been Lois Wassef. And Lois, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
I want to thank as well my colleagues at Copyright Clearance Center for all their help in pulling this program together, Joanna Murphy-Scott and Robin Morgeson in our marketing communications group, Michelle Ayers and Casey Bassett at Educational Services, and on behalf of everyone at Copyright Clearance Center, my name is Chris Keneally. Thank you for joining us today.